Nestor, who was still tending to the injured Machaon, leaves his tent and, upon seeing the ruined wall of the Achaeans, goes to find Agamemnon. Nestor finds the wounded king alongside the also wounded Odysseus and Diomedes. Agamemnon again despairs and orders the Achaeans to prepare to sail home, and he is chastised by Odysseus, who calls him a disaster. It's a wonderful line. You are the disaster, right? Diomedes counsels the wounded kings to return to battle, but inspire the soldiers from behind the front lines. Poseidon favors Agamemnon, and the sea god lets out a cry as nine and 10,000 combat soldiers to strengthen the Achaeans. Meanwhile, Hera, wanting to run interference for Poseidon, plots to make immortal love with Zeus and lure him into a deep sleep. She lies to Aphrodite about her motives and receives from the goddess of love a band with the power to make the sanest man go mad. Hera next enlists the god of sleep to help her overpower Zeus by promising him one of the younger Graces to marry. Hera seduces Zeus, and the father of gods and men is conquered by love and sleep. Sleep tells Poseidon of Zeus's slumber, and the sea god leads the Achaeans against the Trojans. Ajax and Hector clash on the front lines, and Ajax lifts a holding stone, a large stone used to anchor a ship, and strikes Hector. Hector plunged in the dust and was taken back to Troy by his comrades. The retreat of Hector rises the Achaean battle lust. No, raises the Achaean, sorry, we're gonna work on our grammar here. The retreat of Hector raises the Achaean battle lust, and they push back against the Trojans until the knees of every Trojan shook with fear. Homer ends the book with an invocation to the Muses as Poseidon shifts the favor of the war to the Achaeans.
Welcome to the Stand the Great Books podcast, where we are going through a year in Homer in a year.
We got it.
A year in a Homer in a year. Grammar's, we'll work on grammar throughout this whole thing. We welcome back our good friend, Thomas Lackey. Thank you again for hanging out with us. Book 14.
It's a good one.
I got to tell you, as I was going back through book 14 in preparation for this episode, I forgot how funny book 14 is in one part. Like, possibly my, like the funniest part of of the book thus far.
Oh, I just realized what you're talking about. Yeah, we'll get there. It is one of the best lines.
Yeah, it's just like, are you kidding me? Like,
See how you can imagine that it is anything but intentionally comic.
Yeah, intentionally. Yeah. So anyway, I'm really looking forward to book 14. Talking about it. Thomas, again, if you're just now like listening to the show for the first time, go back. We introduced Thomas Lackey last week and the week before when we had David Niles and Thomas Lackey on to talk about book 12, because we just got to the halfway point of the Iliad. Both Thomas and David are in our Sunday Great Books group. So we wanted to kind of bring you back on, and so that way we can talk more about, obviously, the book, but then obviously talk about, just being a part of a group and reading things out loud and the importance of that.
I mean, the group has made it incomparably richer than trying to do it on your own.
Right. So, starting out book 14, we're going to start out with my boy, Nestor.
Who is drinking.
Who is drinking.
And not fighting.
And not fight, but I mean, he's an old man. Give the old man. Like, no. He's a veteran. Like he used to be of the times past.
He is stronger. First off, he has that old man strength, and Homer's already told us he is stronger than the average Achaean. Right, he can lift that bronze goblet off the table.
Yes, of course he can.
And here he is in here just drinking, taking care of the medic.
Well, I mean,
that Paris attacked.
That is true. That, you know what? Like, so that last bit, you know what? Like, puts it over the top.
Can we talk about Paris? Like, so he shot the medic. He shot some dude's horse. Remember that? Like, he's just, man.
You know what? I think if
at least he's not still just polishing his armor.
That's true.
Out of everybody, though, for Nestor to be like
taken care of. I think I would have just let that dude die.
The medic?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's like, well, listen, you got shot by Paris. That's you, like,
oh, that's you on
have,
you.
Yeah, that's on you. Like, you have some bad like omen or something that's going on. I don't want to touch anything that Paris is touching.
That could be true. So where are we? Okay, so Nestor's taking care of the medic. Right here. Line 10. There's a really, I don't know if it's a subtle theme, but it's a theme that I think is worth pointing out because it's one of those themes that's subtle and going to take into great account later in the Iliad. And that's the theme of just shields, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One, we get a lot of description of shields. We don't get like a lot of descriptions of, say, like swords, right? Or even spears. We get a lot of spears, but we don't get descriptions of like, you know, how they're special or whatever.
One or two times you kind of get them mentioned as being unique in some way.
And I think there's two things about the shields. One is just, you know, what do they represent? And two, this capacity of, insofar as they can represent a person, that person can then give their shield to someone else, and they kind of represent them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's kind of a, I think somewhat of a charming father and son thing going on here, where Nestor's son has actually taken the shield of Nestor out into battle, right? And now Nestor has to grab, I think, his son's shield, right, as he kind of steps out because Nestor wants to go see what's going on, right?
Well, I mean, the reason why you retire is for them to call you back.
It's got to be it.
I mean,
but it is interesting, by the way, that his son had his own shield. Right, and then
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because it's not like, oh, mine's broken or whatever. I'm going to use dad's. No, he very consciously carries out his father's.
And we see this, like, you know, Ajax has a famous shield, right? Mm-hmm. What is it, like 7 ox hides or whatever it is? Like this giant, like, tower shield
that
Teucer can, like, dart in and out of and, like, fire arrows and stuff.
Right.
I mean, giant Ajax is really presented as a giant, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, that is a hilarious imagery to think about. Like, some grown man, like, darting around this shield of another guy shooting arrows out of it.
Mm-hmm. You get
while the other man's standing there, you know.
Probably the most famous shield so far is the shield of Zeus, right? The storm shield.
That Athena carries.
Yeah.
And that's another thing is, I think when I was introduced to this, I didn't quite get it, but the and we'll see it later in the Iliad, the shields in that theme really comes to fruition. Is the intimacy between Zeus and Athena, we've talked about a little bit on the podcast, but that she always is carrying his shield. Just as a default, she's carrying his shield and his shirt. She talks about the storm shirt as well. And just that intimacy between the two, you know, that father-daughter relationship, she comes from his mind, right? And so it's just one of the other ones. Is there another shield that I'm missing? We have Ajax, we have Zeus's shield has come up, Nestor's shield has come up.
I mean, there's stuff in the future, of course.
Correct. There's a few that I think we're getting prepped for to understand the mechanics of how this works, because later on it comes in, I think, in a more heavy way. So Nestor goes out. You know, he has to, you know, does he join the Argives or does he go find Agamemnon? He chooses to find Agamemnon. He goes and finds all the wounded warlords, right? Diomedes, Odysseus, Agamemnon.
You could read this two ways, by the way, because here he is debating, what am I going to do? Am I going to go fight or am I going to go counsel? Because that's a, and he decides counsel. Is that a good choice? That's a different question, I think. But I think that's an interesting.
It seems like King Agamemnon needs as much counsel as possible.
And Nestor's playing to his strength, right?
Yeah. That's definitely Nestor's strength. I'm not sure that Nestor's counsel is at its peak here.
Well, what is it? So he goes.
I mean, you can't be batting 1,000, lackey. Like, you know, like you can't always be spot on.
So we have just one thing to note because it confused me, and so I had to look it up. And Fagles actually has a good explanatory note on this: is that when he gets close to the other kings and their ships, it starts talking about a wall, and there's two walls, right?
Oh yeah.
So there's like where all the kings like planted their ships originally, and they built a wall around that. And then there's the later kind of what is called the rampart that they built later on. The rampart has fallen. This defensive wall still stands, right? And they're all wounded behind this wall.
Well, and there's one thing, too, where he says, so when Nestor begins giving some advice, he says, the wall indeed is down that we put our trust in.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be presumably the rampart.
Yeah, this one says the rampart's down. Yeah. They're the great wall we trusted.
Well, so I think this is interesting, the question of if we rewind a ways to the opening of book 12, where there's the preview, essentially, if you want to call it that, of the wall ultimately being destroyed or the rampart being destroyed, that they fail to offer the sacrifices. But mm-hmm. here you have an idea where they have put their trust in this thing that they then did not even bother to offer the appropriate, their trust, and rather than being in the help of the gods, was in this wall. So much so, they didn't even bother to offer the offerings to the gods.
That's interesting.
That's a good insight.
Yeah.
What's interesting to me is that that's not really explained either. I mean, they were offering other sacrifices. They were doing other things. So they're...
No, I think that's a good read. I like that. I'd like to think about that more, about whether that really took a place of a fidelity that they should have owned to the divine. Right? I like that. Things I don't like. So Agamemnon has an idea, which is, again, terrible. And so his idea is we're just going to prep the ships for, I think, running away at night in pitch darkness. But we're going to do that while the other guys hold the line.
Where are you?
This is at the line 80.
Oh, yeah.
Where he starts to talk. And, of course, like, this is a terrible, terrible idea.
Yeah, it's a horrible idea.
Because as soon as the other Achaeans see you start to prep the ships, like, they're going to flee and run, right? Mm-hmm. The line's going to hold. And so I love this because Odysseus points this out to him. It's like, what is this, Atreides, this talk that slips between your clenched teeth? You are the disaster, right? Like, you know what the disaster is about this war? You. Right. You're the disaster.
Can I ask a question? I'd love to get you guys' thoughts on this. Just to backpedal just a few minutes. About 65, when Nestor's talking. Nestor says, "True, too true, a disaster's right upon us. Not even thundering Zeus himself could turn the tide." You know, a couple of episodes ago, we talked about, you know, what's the relationship between fate and Zeus, and is it the same thing? Is it not the mm-hmm. same thing? What was your take there? Like, when?
Well, I'll throw this translation into the mix because I think it
helps.
Yeah, okay. It helps. Okay. So, yes, indeed, these things have happened, are on us. Not even high thundering Zeus himself could have ordered them differently.
So that lands slightly different.
It does land slightly different, but also there's this notion of these things that they are on us. They've happened and they're on us. There's this very much an idea of a stronger sense of fate.
One of the things I find difficult in tracking the conversation between Zeus and is Zeus subject to a nameless fate is that Zeus then can also bind himself to something that's called fate, right? He can bind himself to his own will. And so you can get into a scenario in which if Zeus gives the nod to Thetis about he's going to, you know, allow the Trojans to have victory insofar as it's going to then burn Achaean ships and give glory to Achilles. Like, once he nods and gives that, then you really could say in that context, like, as the ships are burning, even Zeus could not stop this fate, right?
Because he's already committed.
Because he's committed. So it's a little, I don't want to say it's confusing, but I think it begs to actually kind of dig down deeper into more layers, because you can talk about Zeus's own will binding him. And even he can't get out of it once he does that, right? Because that nod is irrevocable. And that still would not be him subject to a nameless fate, right?
Well, and later as we get into the philosophical tradition, you could use that similar language either towards the divine nature or the divine will without implying that there is something yet over those.
Correct. Right?
So, yeah, I mean, I think you have to take account of that. I do get the idea here. I don't know if this passage really elucidates it very much. I will say... That said, I do think in general there's an impression that Zeus is, as I would say, he's weighing the scales, not determining them.
Yeah, yours made it sound much more like he is subject to something, like it's something outside of him that he can't order differently. The Fagel's translation is a little bit more vague. Not even thundering Zeus himself could turn the tide.
Well, I will say that I think in this context, I also read it differently when I first read it, that Nestor here, I don't know, is speaking with great precision. Right? Mm-hmm. I don't know that he's really, for example, giving us a literally true statement. Not even Zeus could have done differently. I mean, I think this might be hyperbolic or just rhetorical.
Right.
Okay. I just wanted to... That was just something that I was...
No, that's a good, that's a good question.
He says something really strange at the end, too. I'm against our joining the battle. A wounded man is in no position to fight. He's not wounded.
Yeah, he's not. This says the last thing I'd urge is to throw ourselves into battle. How on earth can a wounded man make war?
Now, obviously, it is true he's addressing wounded men.
Right.
But he decides, okay, am I going to go talk to the wounded man or am I going to go fight? He goes talks to the wounded man and says, I don't think we should. I think we're done. You know.
Right. Hmm. Okay.
I think it's a good
read. This is a weird thing because Nestor is not generally a coward, by the way. So this is an odd. I'm not sure this is cowardice. I'm not sure what this is.
Yeah, let's see if we can kind of unpack like how through the effects of how his speech actually lands on the wounded kings, if you will. So we get Agamemnon's theory of, you know, let's pack up and we can run away at night. Odysseus calls him out and says he is the disaster.
You are the disaster.
It's just one of the best.
I like how it also has it's in italics. Yeah. I mean, it's like I want to make sure you understand the reader
right.
that he is the disaster.
Yeah, you are the disaster, right? The commander of the armies. Your plan will kill us all. Agamemnon kind of, you know.
So he's not in favor.
Yeah. If you read closely, a subtle, attentive reading is
in between
Odysseus
the lines here.
Does not like this plan, right? It's an esoteric read, but you'll
luckily,
you know
he backs down.
We'll get there. This is really kind of that 1-2 punch of Odysseus and Diomedes. We see this pattern emerging again. We've seen how both of these characters tend to reflect the aspects of Athena. And so here we go. We have Odysseus with the critique and then Diomedes kind of with the positive, like, what should we do? Giving out the whole thing again, I'm the youngest born, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he comes from good stock. He comes from good birth. And so he's still a king and they need to listen to him. So he gives... you know, he gives this plan of, hey, what we could do is go back, but kind of, you know, cheer our men on, command from behind, not really on the front lines, but we're wounded, but we could, you know, we could still be with them as opposed to sitting over here wounded by our ships. So that's like the theory that he gives. The narrative then shifts over to Poseidon, I believe, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And Poseidon sees this dialogue going on, and he comes over and... you know, tugs at Agamemnon and basically ends up favoring him and then releasing a shattering cry, thundering loud as 9,000-10,000 combat soldiers, which is basically then marshaling the power in every single Achaean's heart. So he just releases this you know, war cry that actually then calls them all to rally back to battle. Go ahead.
It's worth noting Diomedes of the Great War Cry or of the War is mentioned. Sometimes he's referred to that way, not always, but he is just before the speech. They Diomedes of the War Cry.
It's interesting because sometimes Menelaus bears that epithet as well. So then we get into the narrative of Hera and Hera's plan to seduce Zeus, which I actually find to be. There's a couple ways to address this. We could address it with, you know, all the seriousness of a bunch of, you know, adolescent junior high kids. But I actually think...
Why'd you look at me? Like, you looked at me when you were saying that.
I still haven't really forgiven you for when I mentioned Uranus the first time. Thomas wasn't here for that. I was literally in the middle of a serious discussion of mythology and just casually mentioned Uranus, and Adam laughed.
I just couldn't help.
So
it had to happen.
I'm just going to say, Adam, just control yourself.
Okay, I'll try my best.
One last Nestorian moment. But I think one way to read it as well is what happens when someone who has great foresight and great ability to convince with words, I think sometimes it's possible for them to imagine they see farther than they can. Right, so that's another possibility that
pride sets in.
Yeah, pride sets in. He's foreseeing defeat, and decides that, you know what, I know better, and you know the jig is up.
Right,
and so that
I mean, most of the things he's been seeing have been like, you know, true.
Yeah, it's true. I think the question there is when does prudence, which I think we would normally accredit him with prudence and counsel, when. If there's insufficient fortitude, when do those begin to fail and, in fact, turn against themselves?
No, I think that's a good insight. You know, one thing, Thomas, you had mentioned, I think, last week was calling out, do we have a definitive moment when Zeus actually stops paying attention to things in the north? And so even here, I noticed, like, so we're shifting to the narrative on Hera, which is around 190 or so. And it just says that, you know, Hera sees that what Poseidon's doing, she wants to support him. But then she saw great Zeus at rest on the ridge, right, up on the heights of Ida. And so she's like, what could she do? And so it's interesting to me that at some point, it's not clear whether Zeus has fully turned his attention back, because you would think if he did, then seeing Poseidon out on the battlefield is going to have an immediate and sudden reaction. So it seems like he's starting to turn back. He's starting. We do have that statement back in the last book about the will of Zeus.
Yeah.
Again, I
and that he spurred some of the soldiers on to action.
I do think we can make a distinction between Zeus actively doing something and his will that has already put things in motion, right? So his will is already carrying things forward, whether or not he's paying attention to him.
Yeah, I think that's a good question as to what extent can the gods' will be carried on without specific attention.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like that there's some tension there, because sometimes when their attention wanders, other things happen, as we'll notice.
So regardless, I mean, I think it's a point that we can note is where is he? It seems, though, my intuition here would be is that he's not paying attention to the north, but he hasn't fully given his attention back to Troy. Therefore, he doesn't have a reaction about Poseidon. And so Hera has to come up with something to distract him. So he does not actually engage Poseidon. So at 200, excuse me, we get her plan.
Well, I will say, by the way, when she observed him, this is my translation, but so Zeus too she observed, and hateful he was to her heart.
This says her heart was filled with loathing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I compressed
that husband-wife relation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's a little elision there in there, but the...
Mm-hmm. So around 200, we get her plan, right? She's going to dress in all her glory and go to Ida. Perhaps the old desire would overwhelm the king to lie by her naked body and make immortal love, and she might drift an oblivious, or so she might drift in an oblivious, soft, warm sleep across his eyes and numb that seething brain. So, you know, she's going to go distract him through Eros, right? Through the erotic. So then she goes and she gets all dolled up, and we get things for that. Athena made for her, and probably then.
What did your notes actually say? Hera getting dolled up.
No.
This is
that's exactly what my notes
are. Did you actually really write that?
I wrote Hera getting dolled up.
Oh, this is why we have to invite Thomas, because we think too much alike. We could have someone else.
In the dolled up sense. Now this is just a translational note, but mine does not. She's like cleanses herself with ambrosia.
Right.
Which is also their food, but it talks here also her about ambrosial robe. Let's see, her hair was plaited in shining tresses, fine and ambrosial. There seems to be ambrosia seems to have a kind of multivalence going on, where it can mean the food that they eat, but there's something beyond that that it also means, and that's why in my footnote, that's why it's untranslated. This particular translator decided in this context, at least, it was untranslatable. It seems to.
Yeah, because this doesn't use that. It talks about wondrous, elegant, golden. It doesn't use it that.
Yeah, it seems this to has translate a note regarding that. That it seems to that the same word is used over and over, and in most translations, it's picked in one meaning, and he just keeps it as it stands. But it seems to be that it can be anything from literally ambrosia to something meaning immortal or sweet or beautiful or.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So notably, the first thing she does is she goes to Aphrodite, who is the goddess, right, of love. And so she lies to her, right? Hera lies to Aphrodite, right? She gives us this thing of like, oh, you know, give me love, give me longing now. The powers you use to overwhelm all the gods and mortal men. There's a line here. There's a lot to unpack here. So let's kind of just slowly work through this. As an aside, after that, Hera mentions that she wants to visit Ocean. This is the lie, right? So I need to, you know, get all dolled up because I need to go visit Ocean, who here is capitalized Ocean as a god. And
who gave gods their being.
Yeah, this translates this as the fountainhead of the gods. And we flagged this because this is not the classical mythology that came down to us, right? This is not the Kronos, Zeus narrative here, which clearly is in Homer. But this question of how can Ocean be seen as the fountainhead of the gods is not entirely clear what mythology Homer is actually drawing from here. Even though there's a few reasons I like tying that back to the ocean, But it's not entirely clear. So it's something the flag, just insofar as we look at different distinctions in mythology, this one is some kind of, Homeric mystery here. So I want to draw out kind of two lines. One is the one I already read, because I want to look at love. And like I said, she says, "Give me love, give me longing now, the powers you use to overwhelm all the gods and mortal men." Aphrodite, says, "Yeah, I'll give into your warm request." And then she talks about the heat of love, and then she gives her a band. And she says of the band, right, "Take this band, put it between your breasts, ravishing open work, and the world lies in its weaving," right? Hera then, let's look at the whole this whole kind of like narrative, and then we kind of circle back to what I think Homer's trying to show us here. So then Hera goes from Aphrodite to sleep, the twin brother of death. So here sleep and death are personified, just like love was. And it's interesting that love is personified outside of Aphrodite, right? And so we're kind of getting into these somewhat primordial gods. And she asks sleep, right? And she calls sleep the master of all gods and all mortal men, which is somewhat similar of what she spoke of love. And so she says, we need to put Zeus to sleep. Sleep is not overly keen on this idea because he's done this before for Hera and he was punished for it.
Which implies that Zeus has at least some power over sleep, just as correct. Sleep has power over Zeus.
His brother, I believe, Night, had to, I think Night's related to them, if I remember correctly. Night personified had to save him, right? And also it says old Night can overpower all gods and mortal men. So now we have love, we have sleep, we have Night, right? That seem to have this power over all the gods and mortal men. Hera is able to convince sleep, right, to help her because she offers sleep one of the graces. It's one of the women, one of the younger graces, and sleep just jumps on this immediately, right? He's like, "Oh yeah, that's great. Like, I'll totally do this," right? And he names the one that he wants. He says, "All my days I've tossed and turned for her."
Presumably, sleep is coming under the influence of the band.
What did it translate in yours? Yeah, let me see. Do you remember?
Yeah, let me go back.
Band is a little bit vague.
It just says breast band. Okay. You would naturally think something like a necklace, but it doesn't seem to be. It seems to be something that must clasp around.
I think it's, and even between, right? I think at least in this translation it says you have to put it between your breasts. But no, I think that's a great read, is that we think she's getting all dolled up and having, this effect of love on her, and we're seeing this as that she's prepping for Zeus, but even when she goes to sleep, I think that effect of love is already taking root, right? Mm-hmm. So you actually see sleep kind of enticed and lured into this by a romantic desire. So he agrees, and so she goes up to Zeus. It says at once all the lust came swirling, over him, right? She goes up and dresses him. He definitely understands what's going to happen. And then Adam, would you like to just lead us through, Zeus's response?
I just can't help, but while I'm reading this, to just like think about how juvenile of a response this is. So like, he's sitting there, he knows what's about to happen. And he's like, "Oh, you're just so beautiful. Never have I lusted over somebody like I'm lusting over you. Not even this woman or this woman or this woman. I've never lusted over you like this woman." And like he gives this whole litany of women that
it's quite a list too.
Yeah, that he has just lusted over and desired and,
Yeah, this is like
his
the
whole
most
body count, so to speak.
Yeah, this is like the most on-brand Zeus moment I've seen in the whole text.
Well, and I didn't get to mention this on Sunday, but it's even worse than it sounds. Because the first person he mentions, the wife of Ixion, a son of Zeus himself, tried to rape Hera. So this is not how, to mention this as your start.
Right.
But not only that, Ixion's wife had a son who was then known as a notorious adulterer. So his first pick is to pick someone who tried to assault his wife, and then he has an illegitimate, or we say illegitimate, I don't know how to call it when it's Zeus, but
you're right.
then has a reputation for pursuing exactly this kind of behavior. And I can't believe that that's accidental, that that's the first one that's named.
Yeah, I would imagine that if we sat down and parsed out all of these myths of all these women he's listing, a lot of them are going to be tragic, right? I mean, another one here is Dionysus is mentioned, right? And the woman that bore him, which is also, that's the one in which Hera gets incredibly jealous about and tricks her into asking Zeus to reveal himself in all his glory. And he does, and she burns to a crisp. Right. I mean, just all these not only is it just like the most on-brand Zeus moment ever to list all the, like, oh, I'm lusting for you more than this woman and this woman, and just remind her of all the adultery that you've committed. But then also, like, they're all just wrapped up in the most sordid stories.
But there's something here about someone with lovely ankles or something. Like, it's like, it's just
That's a good epithet.
Well, I mean, you know, Zeus is not known for his foreplay.
His marvelous ankles.
I'm just saying that, I mean, he doesn't, it's just, yeah, it's the most on-brand thing possible. And it goes on for quite a while. That's
I think actually that is the humorous part of this. Because it's one thing for Zeus to say, like, oh, I lust over you more than this person or this person. Even if this person is pretty cringe, right, with the backstory. It's more that he thinks that he hasn't made his point.
Yeah, I need a couple more examples.
I need to draw this out to make sure you really know what I mean.
And this is where I think some people would point and say, this is so absurd. And it also so clearly shows Zeus, right, the primary god, the god that is more powerful than all the other gods, in such a human, like, sordid passion.
Right.
That it's hard. It's hard for a lot of people not to read this and see this as a critique of the gods.
I think it has to be.
Just see, like, this is so over the top and so just like he's subject to human passion that there is a critique here of, look, this is the god of the gods and it's a joke.
Yeah, I don't see how different would the sensibilities have to be for somebody not to snicker at this. I can't imagine human beings just being that different, that this is not presented in a way that's simply absurd. It's not funny it's so absurd,
right,
that it has to be funny.
Well, clearly, like, the sensibilities, right? I mean, Hera is known for her jealousy, right? The fact that the wife is jealous of what, you know, Zeus does and all this adultery. I mean, that dynamic between Zeus and Hera, right, even if that's the only context you take, this is an insane thing. And also, another thing to point out is, for her to put up with this, to still go through with the act of making immortal love after he does this, simply because you are using your sexual relationship with your husband as a form of deceit, right?
Which is, you know, not to skip too far ahead, I think this might be why he's so outraged when he discovers what's going on.
Well, in some commentary, they bring the parallels to what Zeus says to Hera, like, that he can't wait, like, this is overcome, like, this passion is overcome, similar to what Paris says to Helen.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that this passion has just taken over him. And then it's like, well, so you're equating the god, like you were saying, Deacon, like, you're equating these passions of men and equating it to, like, a god is subjected to it as well, and not only subjected to it, but like
mastered by it.
Yeah, mastered by it.
Yeah. So let's pivot off that mastered by it, right? So Zeus falls for this, right? And you get this whole deal. And then around 420, Homer says, "And so deep in peace, the father slept on the Gargan peak, conquered by sleep in the strong assaults of love. his wife locked in his arms. And so this is what I'd like to take a step back and look at, and I want to couple together a few statements. One is, when she goes to Aphrodite, the one I already read, but it's worth revisiting, "Give me love," capitalized, "give me longing now, the powers you use to overwhelm all the gods and mortal men," right? Which now we see includes Zeus. Then we see that inside the band, the breast band that she's wearing, in that, the whole world lies in its weaving. Then we come to the fact that Zeus, the god who is more powerful than all the other gods, is conquered by sleep and love. And I think this really raises the question of, what is the relationship? I mean, we kind of have this smattering of what you might call these more primal, these more primordial gods. What is the relationship between Zeus, you know, the head of Olympus, to these more primordial gods? Any hot takes on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think this would also tie to some extent with the question of whether or not Zeus is mastered by fate. Because I think once you sort of have a chink that Zeus can be mastered by anything, there's a chance that he's subject to more than one thing.
No, I completely agree with that. I actually had written out here just fate question mark, because I agree with you. If he can be conquered by sleep and love, even if only in a moment, right? And say he wakes up later in a rage and does whatever else to these gods, the fact he can be conquered by them, right, seems to then open up the conversation, and for me, tends to lean more towards the fact that, you know, he also can be subject and conquered by fate as well.
It's interesting as well, I think, here to think of Zeus. This is going to be a very bizarre way to phrase it, because we were just talking about his, you know, ridiculous adulteries and things. I think Zeus is slightly innocent here in that he does not trust Hera. He has been very clear that he doesn't trust Hera, but he does trust Hera about this. He doesn't think she's up to anything here. Not yet. I don't think so. I don't think he, I think that there's, so there's an image when she comes to him of the grass springing up around them and flowers and things like that.
Right.
That has it. Obviously, there's an image there that of, you know, fertility, but I don't think it's just that. I think there's an instance, I mean, there's again an idea of goodness and I don't know how to put it again other than that the general impression here is not of deception and sordidness, but of love and creation. Right. And the fact that that's being misused is, I think, surprising even to Zeus.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that I do think there's a misuse of a good here, right? The sexual relationship between husband and wife. My initial take on this was that Zeus is so overcome with lust immediately that he doesn't ever seem to really even question her intent. And of course, she gives this kind of coy, like, oh, I'm just stopping by because I'm going to go see Ocean, right? Yeah. Like X, Y, and Z. He doesn't really ever. So part of it was like, is his mind so clouded? Is it a trust? Or he just doesn't even take the moment to even like think, right? Because when lust is typically, you know, tied to an intellectual blindness.
Yeah. Because of what does Aquinas to us. Brings this out. Yeah. One question that I don't know the answer to, but it would be interesting. The flowers and things are named crocuses and hyacinths and things like that. I would wonder if they had any specific symbolic meaning within Greek culture.
Yeah, that would be interesting, though, to see if there's, because there's this kind of beautiful imagery that's used. And I do agree that then the imagery that's used up on the mountain, right? He's going to wrap them in the clouds, et cetera. Are very fertile in their imagery, right?
Yeah.
But there's a good here, but it's a good being misused. And again, I think you see how deeply deceit sometimes is kind of soaked into the bones of Greek mythology. You know, even the sacrifices they make to Zeus are predicated off of deceit, right? So that they tricked him into what, you know, or Prometheus did, what the men have to offer him. You know, Hera uses this to trick him. Zeus constantly is deceiving Hera so she doesn't try and catch his, you know, adultery. So no, I think those are good questions. I'd like to take a step back and, you know, this understanding of Zeus then conquered by, let's take love, for example, these more primordial gods. There's a, I think we've mentioned it before, but there's Homer, and he's at what, like 850? And so in the 700s, there's another Greek poet, which is basically the only other ancient Greek poet that we have, Hesiod. He wrote a few works, but one of them is the Theogony, which is a, it's very short compared to the Iliad. It's only about 1,000 lines. So it's one of the long, it would be compared to one of the longer books, right, in the Iliad. And the whole thing, it's not really exciting reading. The whole thing is literally just a genealogy of the gods. Mm. Where do the gods come from? You know, things of this nature. And the thing I think that's really interesting is that in his, there's these primordial gods that come first and actually predate things. So I'm actually going to turn to our guide to kind of point out how this works. And so it says, though he lived after Homer, Hesiod, like Homer, is weaving together long-standing traditions in Greek mythology into a coherent whole. For Hesiod, the world starts with the primordial gods of chaos, and then earth, or Gaia, the abyss, and then love, Eros. And pertinent to our passage in Homer, chaos then gives birth to night, and night gives birth to doom, fate, death, sleep, and dreams. So in Hesiod's, like, and I talk about this more and more in the guide and kind of parse this out, but in Hesiod's Theogony, there's these primordial gods that come first, right? Like chaos and earth, abyss, but then love, right? Eros, right? Our erotic love.
And these get affirmed by, say, Socrates in a way that Zeus does not, just to...
Correct. You know, yes.
Leap ahead a few centuries.
Just a few centuries. But yeah, so I think that... No, but I think what you're seeing here is the groundwork laid for some very serious conversations about what actually does move the cosmos, right? So if we look at these guys like Hesiod and Homer as teachers, and what they're trying to do is they're literally looking at nature and trying to observe certain things and take the mythologies that they receive and try and articulate the realities around them without, say, the benefit of divine self-revelation through like scripture and like Hebrew culture. I think there's things to note here. And I think that it's really fascinating that the primary god, the god that's more powerful than all the other gods, can be conquered by these primordial ones.
Yeah, and I think as well there's a question here. So Aphrodite is associated with love, but she then has this device,
the band.
The band that in some ways, I want to use the word personification, but it doesn't work because it doesn't seem to be a person, but it seems to be related to Eros, right?
Right.
It seems to be somehow a at least physical manifestation of Eros.
Yeah, no, and I think that, because you see then that erotic love played out with sleep after, you know, like, the young Grace. And then you see that erotic love played out upon Zeus for Hera. And I think that I want to build off what you said, because this is why it kind of captures my imagination, is because sometimes the modern Christian tradition hasn't picked this up as well, but like, where does Eros go in this, right? So we kind of get a snapshot here in Homer, and I think this is pretty much the snapshot we have. Then in Hesiod, also in Eros is one of the four primary cosmic gods. And really, there's a good debate that it's Eros that then actually, because we don't really get a description of where the four come from, right? But then it's Eros that makes the cosmos have its fecundity.
Well, right. And also that it's Eros that in some sense brings a principle of unity, right? And I don't just mean the union between spouses, but a unity of elements, a unity of things. This is brought out some in the symposium. But I think there's a question to how you might even apply it to this text, because as Eros here is withdrawn, if we associate this with, and misused, if you turn to the battlefield, the brutality and the... lack of any sort of common, you know, brotherhood of humanity also withdraws. Right? So
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing where that I think the violence has been ramping up anyway, but this withdraw and misuse of love seems to be amplified in the battle.
Yeah, no, I like that. I'd have to think about that more. I think that for the sake of maybe my own interest, let me just map this out real fast, because I think this is a theme to track. And it's a theme that's, again, like I've said, and probably I'm using it too often, but it's really nascent in Homer, right? We're seeing what we're seeing in Homer in a lot of ways is he's raising questions or pointing out themes that then, excuse me, start to develop in the West. And so I think one of them is Eros. And so here we kind of have this, you know, question of like, wait, how can Zeus be conquered by love? How can Zeus be conquered by Eros? This kind of erotic desire. Hesiod, then we see, presents Eros in this more cosmic sense, right? As you kind of alluded to, not even just between like husband and wife. And we kind of want to reduce Eros, the erotic, to simply sexuality.
But it's actually better than sex.
But it's, I'm glad you're here. I am here. For those playing along at home, Adam's making fun of me for an article that I wrote on Eros because the subject's actually close to my heart, which is what I was trying to explain. And I published it on Catholic Answers, and they retitled it Better Than Sex. And Adam has never let me forget it because that title went over like a lead balloon with a lot of people and had a lot of questions. So anyway, even though I love Catholic Answers, so anyway, but thank you, Adam, for that aside.
Just perfect.
Yeah, thanks.
It lined up.
This is what happened when we do the podcast late into the evening. So anyway, so you see the Eros becomes this more cosmic, and just like to trace this, so you already mentioned the symposium. The symposium then is literally an entire Platonic dialogue on who or what is Eros, the erotic. And this is this plays out, I think, heavily with Plato, in which Plato starts to, I think, challenge our notion that Eros is just this kind of raw, primal, sometimes even this kind of Dionysian, bestial, right, love, and that actually Eros is not a downward spiral. It is an upward movement, right? That Eros actually is
an ascent.
Yeah, it's an ascent, and where you actually move from lesser beauties to greater beauties until you actually can satiate in beauty itself, which is God. And this is even a pagan that can actually see this text. And so we ascend, which is probably we're pulling the veil back a little bit on where we came up with the name for our podcast, but, you know, the erotic. And so you actually can ascend from lesser beauties to greater beauties. And even then, say, Aristotle later. So you have Plato, then Aristotle. Even Aristotle will say, you know, how does the unmoved mover move all things if the unmoved mover does not move, right? Talking about the divine. Like, how can the divine be at the center of the cosmos and move all things in being, but it itself is unmoved, right? It can't move because it's perfect. There can't be change in it. Mm-hmm. And his answer is Eros, that all things...
move by love.
Yeah, all things are moved by love. All things desire to be satiated by satiating in the one, right? The unmoved mover. And so Eros takes on that cosmic force, which is really what we see in Hesiod, right? That beginning love.
Well, the creative force as well, that things are essentially, that love brings things into existence.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, so just, and I'll round it off and then, you know, we can move on. But I think that, even though I am looking forward to revisiting the symposium at some point when we get to this, we'll only have 14 episodes on that one little text. But I think that, you know, for those that are like, this is really foreign, right? Like, you know, because a lot of our particularly Protestant tradition, and unfortunately our Catholic tradition has somewhat adopted this in the last 100 years, really has seen Eros as something competitive with agape, right? So St. Paul talks about agape. He talks about this selfless love, right? Mm-hmm. This divine love. And sometimes you'll see in this kind of Protestant tradition of, oh yeah, we have Plato's Eros, right? This kind of self-love, right? Contrasted or competitive with a selfless love of St. Paul. And this is really, I think, a misread on the tradition. And if you're looking for a good place to say, well, where would I go to maybe read some more about this? Or like, you know, I don't see Eros as a positive. I don't see Eros as like in this tradition. I think the easiest place to start and where a lot of my journey started was Pope Benedict XVI's Deus Caritas Est, right? God is love. He actually gives a defense of Eros, of erotic love, in that encyclical. It's not too long, but he actually steps in and says, no, this is actually part of the tradition. Eros is not a negative in and of itself. We all have a natural love, a self-love that needs to be satiated, right? That needs to be sated. We need to feel loved.
Well, and of course, I mean, the grand analogy in Scripture is of Christ as the bridegroom and the church as bride. Right, it's baked into the same. Also, and of course, Israel is put in the same analogy. So I don't see how it could be anything but a misread. I would also say that St. John Chrysostom's homilies on Ephesians are, I mean, now they're not specifically using the word eros, but of drawing from the theme of love between man and wife and ascending to higher love is a strong element in his.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that too, you see this with, I agree with you because it's hard to say, well, eros doesn't play into like my relationship with God, et cetera, when God used erotic imagery, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, as the primary way to express his relationship to humanity, right? Israel's the bride, then the church is the bride. Some of the texts in the Old Testament on eros are incredibly explicit.
Well, of course, the Song of Songs itself is the same analogy. I mean, you could imagine that he could have expressed his love, and he does do this, to express it as the love of a father for a child. I mean, that's definitely in there. But it's not the primary analogy that he picks.
Correct. So I think that, because Adam's starting to give me the look that this podcast is not about Eros, and so we need to move on book 14. So I think I'll round out discussion just saying, like, this is why we read the Iliad, because here's this rich tradition that we just basically just charted out, 2,800 years of thought in the Western world about what does Eros mean, leading all the way up to, like, you know, a great thinker like Pope Benedict XVI. And that really starts here in this somewhat innocuous little text about Zeus and Hera, right? But there's a question then about what is the relationship of this kind of primal love to the divine? And the last pitch I'll get, and maybe we can put it in the show notes, even though that was a term that Adam had to teach me like two shows ago, because I don't know what that means. But maybe Adam can do it, is to put in the show notes for the Alcuin Institute, I wrote an article called In Defense of Erotic Love, which then tries to just quickly trace this genealogy throughout pagan and then Catholic thought that actually tries to defend Eros, I think, from a Protestant misread.
Well, I think the last thing I would say on this is, despite the fact that we know Hera here is engaged in a deception, I think the imagery that Homer chooses is intentionally sacred. And I think he's drawing some sort of... I think there's a contrast in that, because to misuse the sacred is an even greater offense.
Yeah. No, I agree. Okay. You know, this also shows, you know, we're talking about Hesiod and Homer. There are distinctions between their mythologies. A really famous one is Aphrodite. So if you remember earlier on, when Aphrodite is speared and goes up to Olympus, she has a mother, and her mother comforts her. In Hesiod, and then basically the greater classical mythology after him, Aphrodite simply arises from the sea. So actually it is, what is it? Kronos. Is it Kronos? Yeah, Kronos actually cuts off Uranus's genitals, so he can't have any more children.
And then throws it in the sea.
And throws it in the sea, and that actually spontaneously makes Aphrodite. And Aphrodite's name... the etymology there is foam, like sea foam. And so the actual mythology of how she came about is slightly more graphic than the nice Renaissance paintings of her like arising from a seashell. But it's a difference in the Homer and, say, Hesiod mythology.
Strangely similar thing in Egyptian mythology, but I can't remember. Something maybe with Osiris. Anyway, I'd have to go back and read, but it's just strange about things being locked off and
creating results.
Creating things.
Yeah, that tends to be a theme.
Yeah.
So, okay, we will move on from Eros. Thank you, Adam, for your patience. I appreciate it.
I feel like I added a lot there.
That's fine. You did. You gave me a look of like, stop talking about it. Okay. So I just think it's been a...
you've been waiting for it. Hey, you've been very patient.
I know.
We're over halfway
through.
In
your defense, I think Plato agrees, right? I mean, so.
I mean, you know, and to push back a bit, you know, here we are really starting to pull back the veil a bit about where the name of our podcast actually comes from, right? So we'll kind of leave that as a cliffhanger. So any other comments on Zeus and Hera and this kind of... trickery before we move on? We've pretty much exhausted it.
Yep.
Okay. So we have, then we shift back to Poseidon. Sleep goes down. Sleep personified goes back and tells Poseidon, like, you know, fight for the Argives now with all your might, because, you know, Zeus is now in a deep sleep. And so Poseidon then does exactly that. And so he kind of pushes that, and we get another Hector versus Ajax battle a little after 480. He grabs a rock, a holding stone, which is like an anchor. So this is a fairly large rock. He heaved it at Hector's chest, and it struck him over the shield rim close to the throat. And Hector does not take this well. He plunges in the dust. His companions have
Shocker.
To... you know, his companions
have
to...
He didn't take this well as the... Yeah, just the rock getting thrown into his throat. Like, I don't know a lot of guys who would take that very well.
It says, you know, well, you never know in the Iliad. He might have just, you know, it might have just broke on him like, you know, his skin is bronze. You just never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
As part of the, you know, the just kind of fickle nature of the gods, right? Hector, this is a little bit for 520, right? Hector tries to catch his breath, his eyes cleared. And then he goes down and vomits dark clots, and then the world goes black across his eyes again. So he is not doing well.
Yeah, typically the imagery for death. I mean, this is used over and over again. And I guess there's one question as to whether or not, well, just how close to death Hector is here.
Correct. Well, yeah, in my notes, you know, for the, as a first time reading through this, I thought, like, I was putting in questions like, is this the first time this phrase doesn't mean death?
Yeah, that's a good question.
In the Iliad?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I think so, but I'm not positive.
I certainly associate it with death, given everything that's happened.
So here, by the way, is Ajax. I think I might be just slightly behind you, mocking Polydamas. He throws a spear at him and ends up killing someone else and says...
No, that's right after.
Yeah.
It's at 540 for us.
Here again, is this is not Ajax and Hector agreeing to, you know, give each other a decent burial, whoever wins this fight, right? Our brotherhood here has been shattered.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting here, though, is that we have a corpse trade, right? Which I'm not sure if we've seen before, where actually there's a dead body on both sides, and they want to be able to give their comrades the proper rituals and not see them mutilated. And so I can't recall if there's one previous to this, we actually get the, you know, should we actually just trade corpses so our comrades can actually have their proper rights? So let's see here.
More foreshadowing.
Correct. Yeah, I think that's, you know, and some people might be like, man, they're really pushing. I understand that corpses are important, or why do we keep bringing that up, or why do we bring up shields? It's because, like, there is a lot of groundwork being laid to then understand things later, I think, in the Iliad that make a lot more sense if you've been kind of paying attention to how important these things are. We get the poor guy that gets lanced between the brows down to the eye's roots and scooped out his eyeballs. The eye's root, that was a very...
Yeah, but I think that's a quick death. I think I'd probably take that over getting stabbed
between the navel and the genitals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. Is it the same guy whose head gets lifted up as a pike? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they put his head on a pike?
Yeah.
Yeah, which again goes back to that thing of, like, is the savagery of the Iliad increasing as we move along?
He held it aloft and displayed it like a puppy head to the Trojans.
Is that little Ajax doing that?
That's good.
Or no, that was... No, little Ajax was the one that threw the head at the guy at one point.
Yeah, tell the dear father and mother of the lordly Ilioneus from me to begin mourning in their halls for the wife of Alaginor's son, Promachos. I'm probably butchering these names. Will never welcome back her dear husband. I mean, this is different, right? I mean, people have been dying all along. We've seen lots and lots of dead people, but this is what I was getting at when I was talking about that there's no unity here anymore, even within the midst of the conflict.
Yeah, one thing Adam and I were discussing earlier was simply just like that because they give all the names and the genealogies, like there's a lot of personal nature to the war itself.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're kind of seeing that shift to a different degree, insofar as like the type of taunts and the level of depravity you can mention about someone in war if you actually know their backstory, right? And also just to go, just to even have like these taunts and go through the capacity to do this in the middle of a war. Because sometimes we see this, right? Nestor would be like, hey, guys, be quiet, like just fight. Right. Right? We're going to see this later in the text too, in which they're trying to push.
How are I supposed to keep the guy's attention?
I know. Yep. So then the book ends, which we should always pay attention to an invocation of the muses.
Yeah.
So the muses come back, right? Who was the first Achaean to drag off bloody spoils as the famous god of earthquakes turned the tide? So there he's playing with, you should love that. Does that count as a pun? And so, you know, he's playing with his metaphors again. Yeah, very good.
Also, just to note, like, you know, quick Ajax, little Ajax gets a shout out at the very end that a lot of people don't, you know, you don't catch, but this dude kills the most. It says, no one alive could run men down in fight like him. Once Zeus whipped enemy ranks in the blinding panic rout.
Yeah, so little Ajax is pretty good about doing that, eh?
Yeah, like he, you know, that's just a kind of a, big Ajax gets a lot of the, attention when it comes to fighting, but a little Ajax isn't bad either.
No, he's not.
And I will say, I think the last death here, Hyperainor, I'm not sure of the pronunciation of the name, but this translation has an interesting line that his soul burst through the open wound, which is...
Yeah, this says, this is Menelaus, right, that does this. He gouged his flank and the bronze ripped him open, spurting his entrails out and his life gushing forth through the raw, yawning wound. So yours actually says soul there.
Yeah, it says soul instead of life.
Yeah, that's an interesting, it really changes that picture, actually.
Yeah, I do like it. I wasn't actually sure exactly which one it was, Menelaus or Agamemnon, because it's Atreus' son. I'm like, I don't know which one, but yeah.
And this one says Menelaus. Yeah.
Okay, very good. Any other comments, anything on book 14? A good book, I think. A book on its face that might not seem to offer a whole lot, but then kind of that foreshadowing of the Eros tradition, I think it's actually a very rich text.
I think it's also an example of, I think, a repeated theme that of joking about serious things. Because he introduces an element of comedy about a very serious aspect of the story.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to take more seriously how Homer uses humor.
Yeah.
And is he being humorous? Because a lot of people would say he's not, right? But I tend to think that he does use humor, and he also uses irony.
Yeah, irony is just very, very visible.
Well, I mean, when we go, again, way later, Plato is very funny. So there's a strong element of humor about serious topics.
Yeah, well, because that irony gives layers to the text, right? So you're rewarded with attentive reading by picking up on these ironies because they're funny or they lead you to a deeper understanding. So, okay, very good. Well, we have Visit Ascend, the Great Books Podcast website, which is actually just thegreatbookspodcast.com,
yeah,
right?
Or Ascend the Great Books Podcast, yeah.
Yeah, and we have our guide on there, a bunch of other stuff. Like us on Twitter, YouTube, whatever else.
MySpace.
We are not on TikTok. And, you know, say hi.
Any last thoughts, Thomas?
Nope.
Hey, I appreciate you being here with us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks, Thomas.
We'll see you next week.